Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In his latest book, best-selling author Christopher Ryan considers whether modern civilization is truly making progress and questions the assumption that progress is inherently good. Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress, is published by Avid Reader Press, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and brings Christopher Ryan to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You write that we have an optimism bias, which leads us to a blind faith in progress. Wasn't Stephen Jay Gould, the noted evolutionary biologist, also a critic of progress? You quote him as writing, "Progress is a noxious, culturally embedded, untestable, non-operational, intractable idea that must be replaced if we wish to understand the patterns of history." How was he defining progress, and what did he suggest we replace it with?
That's an interesting question. I think that what he was referring to was the confusion of evolution with progress, which is ubiquitous in people's understanding of evolution, thinking that species are improving. I think it sort of goes back to the survival of the fittest mm-hmm. trope, meaning that those that survive are fitter than those that didn't, and therefore evolution is a process of constantly refining and becoming more and more fit creatures, which isn't the case. In fact, biological evolution is simply constantly adapting to a changing environment, both social and ecological. But there's no progress. An animal living right now is not any better or more refined or more complete than an animal that was living thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago. So I think that's what Gould was getting at. I quote him just because I love the sentences and it's sort of so unhinged, you know. But I think it's important to think about this in terms of social evolution as well. Progress, we talk about people who changed the world. Recently, Columbus Day, Christopher Columbus changed the world, but the presumption seems to be that he changed it for the better. And everyone who changes the world changes it for the better. But in fact, history doesn't show a process of constantly improving and getting better. This is an untestable, unverifiable assumption that we make. And it leads us to conclusions that are totally ill-founded, like that right now is the best time to ever have been alive. I think most people assume that to be true. But if you start to unpack it and actually look closely at it, you find that it's impossible to come to that conclusion.
I want to get back to Columbus later. But you argue in your book that people today are not happy. You say we work at jobs we hate, eat foods that has been drained of nutrition, live in overcrowded cities where we are cut off from nature and from one another, and suffer from diseases that are byproducts of civilization itself. But if you ask people, wouldn't they say that they're kind of happy?
Well, it depends who you ask and when you ask them. You know, recent surveys show that about 25% of people in the United States live alone. That's not a sign of happiness and progress when the worst punishment reserved for the worst criminals is solitary confinement. I have a buddy who's a fireman in Portland, Oregon. We were speaking recently about some of the horrible things that he sees when he goes out on calls. And he said to me, "Man, I'll tell you, worse than the traffic accidents and the suicides and everything else I see is the loneliness." Mm-hmm. People who call 911 just for someone to talk to. That's out of sight. So maybe we're not as aware of it as we should be. I think it's indisputable that people are, rates of depression. Depression, the World Health Organization has called out depression and chronic anxiety at epidemic levels. Suicide rates are increasing. Antidepressant prescriptions for children are increasing rapidly year after year. These are not signs of a healthy society. A third, the World Health Organization just reported a couple of weeks ago, a third of the children in the world are malnourished. This is not where you would expect a society to be after thousands of years of improvement and progress.
But haven't medical advances improved our lives? Although you do note that hunter-gatherers had healthier teeth.
Healthier teeth, healthier bones, healthier hearts. Pretty much anything you look at, hunter-gatherers are healthier than modern people are. You know, the one area that is a legitimate improvement over hunter-gatherer time is infant mortality. And we can get into those numbers if you'd like. But
sure.
Basically, hunter-gatherers experience high rates of infant mortality. Somewhere between 30 and 40% of children die before the age of 10.
And why is that? Just simply because of their way of life, moving around all the time?
Some of those children die because they're born with disabilities that don't allow them to survive in a hunter-gatherer world. So these are children whose disabilities would have been detected in prenatal testing today and probably be aborted. But a lot of, you know, there's infection, snake bites, falls, you break your leg, that can, you know, you don't have that kind of emergency room trauma treatment. But it should be noted that in 1800 in Europe, over 40% of the children died before the age of 10, before the age of 5, excuse me. And so infant mortality only decreased under 10% in the last 100 years. So when we're comparing the modern world to the past, it's important to determine exactly where in the past we're looking.
Because we could say that if we're comparing ourselves to the hunter-gatherers, there we have one set of standards. But if we compare ourselves to the way people lived 100 years ago, 150 years ago, don't we have a whole other set of standards?
Oh, exactly. Because, for example, the biggest killers of humanity are infectious diseases, right? And people often say to me, well, we have vaccines now and antibiotics and, you know, it's
I was going to say that.
Yeah, I anticipated it. But here's the thing. The antibiotics and the vaccines are protecting us against diseases that didn't exist until the advent of agriculture and civilization. So hunter-gatherers don't have to worry about cholera and smallpox and chickenpox and influenza. All these issues were not dangerous, were not even extant in hunter-gatherer times. The biggest killers of humanity are all pathogens that jumped over to our species from domesticated animals. Tuberculosis from cattle, smallpox, chickenpox from ducks and chickens, obviously. Influenza from pigs, other fevers from pigs. So these, it's like we're saying, well, our ancestors all must have died in traffic accidents because they didn't have seatbelts and airbags, ignoring the fact that they didn't drive cars. So most of the miracles of modern medicine are partial fixes to problems that were in fact caused by civilization. Hunter-gatherers don't have obesity, they don't have heart disease, they don't have hypertension, diabetes, on and on and on.
You studied psychology. Are you arguing something different than what Sigmund Freud did in his famous book, Civilization and Its Discontents?
Well, I think my previous book, Sex at Dawn, gets into sort of overlaps with Freud's beliefs about the sublimation and redirecting of erotic energy more. I think in Civilized to Death, I'm not really arguing that civilization is a product of this erotic energy being redirected. There's certainly some conflict between civilization and our human eroticism. But I do think that, you know, Freud was onto something when he pointed out that civilization really doesn't seem to make people very happy. As you said earlier, people might say they're happy because, hey, we're happy to be alive. People are happy and can adapt to almost any condition. And gratitude is a healthy way to approach life. But if you step back and want to make some objective measures or comparisons between different ways of living, and you look at things like leisure time, a sense of community, healthy, varied, interesting sex life, autonomy, all these measures, nutritional food, general well-being in terms of physical health, absence of depression and suicidal impulses, all of these measures will show us that hunter-gatherers were healthier and happier than the typical modern human being is today.
You're right that despite the marvels of our age, or maybe because of them, these are deeply troubled times. Now, are you also talking about the current troubled political situations in many countries around the world? Or are we talking, are you talking about different kinds of deeply troubled times?
Well, take your pick. We've got political troubles. We've got ecological troubles. We have economic troubles. The world is teetering on the edge of something, quite clearly.
And, well, we've seen the growth of autocracies around the world. You would have thought that we would have learned the lessons of World War II. But now we have neo-Nazis, we have neo-fascists, and it's happening. Some of the same things that led to World War II are popping up again.
I agree. And I think, you know, when I write about the political organization of hunter-gatherers and sort of try to look at the modern world through that prism, I keep coming back to the conclusion that anarchy doesn't scale. You know, I think you can look at the current political debates in the United States, and they're sort of perennial debates between one side saying, you know, we should share, we should take care of each other, we're all part of a community, we should all contribute to that community and make sure no one's left behind. Sort of a progressive left-leaning perspective.
We've made major advances in civil rights and other personal freedoms.
Sure, exactly. And that perspective and that sort of that appetite for egalitarianism and inclusion aligns very well with the hunter-gatherer way of life. That's what a hunter-gatherer band looks like. And then the other side, which is more, you know, private property, I've got mine, keep your hands off my stuff, deregulate, that's very much an agricultural sort of farming perspective on life. So maybe it's my personal bias having immersed myself in these, in this research for so many years, but I see this very essential human debate playing out again and again throughout history between community and inclusion and individuality and sort of private property.
So in hunter-gatherer societies, there is nobody who says, hey, I'm the strongest person here. I'm going to be the leader. I'm going to be the tribal chief.
No, that's the opposite of how politics works in hunter-gatherer societies. Interestingly, it's quite the opposite of what we see now. In a hunter-gatherer band, for people who aren't familiar with this this research, the group would never be more than 150 people. And that's that comes back to something called Dunbar's number, named after Robin Dunbar, the biologist, who determined that the human brain is capable of keeping track of about 150 people. That's related to the proportion of our neocortex to the rest of the brain. He did studies in other social primates and found a correlation. And what you find, in fact, is that even if there's plentiful food and resources, the group, when it reaches around 150 people, will splinter into smaller groups. And so everyone knows one another in a hunter-gatherer band. So reputational damage is very important. Status accrues to someone who is admired by other people. One becomes a leader because other people value your opinion. So when it's time to make a decision, if a lot of people say, well, let's ask Leonard, because Leonard tends to be right, he's wise, he's kind, that's how you become a leader, not by saying, I want to be a leader. If you declare that you have an interest in telling other people what to do, what you've done is disqualified yourself because you've made yourself ridiculous. Leadership is something that is requested of people. It's not something that's thrust upon the group by, a selfish infiltrator or, some sort of Trumpian figure. So everything's back.
So the Trumpian figures or the people who declare themselves as candidates for the presidency, that's something that only has occurred more recently? We've had a long thousands and thousands of years of rulers, of kings, of emperors. When did things change?
Anatomically modern human beings have existed for roughly 300,000 years. That's the current estimate.
And do we know when language developed?
No, we don't know because the vocal cords don't fossilize, and so there's no way to really answer that question. We know that people had vocal cords. Their bodies look the same as ours in terms of skeletal remains. Their brain capacity actually was about 10% greater. We've lost about 10% of our brain capacity in the last few thousand years. But agriculture arose in the last 10,000 years at the most. So we're looking at a small, very small fraction of our existence as a species living in hierarchical, agricultural, settled villages with the domesticated animals and all the ills that we spoke about earlier. This is when politics changed into a top-down hierarchical or organizational system. Previous to that, hunter-gatherer groups, all, wherever they're found in the world, are all egalitarian. In fact, anthropologists describe them as fiercely egalitarian. They defend their right to individual autonomy fiercely. No one can really tell anyone else what to do because no one controls access to resources. This is the crucial change in the way our ancestors lived. Hunter-gatherers, everyone has access to resources. Everyone knows where the fruit trees are. Everyone knows how to build a shelter, how to fish, how to net. So everyone has equal access to resources. And the central organizing principle of hunter-gatherer groups is sharing. And I know this is going to sound to some listeners like a Rousseauian fantasy, but in fact, the reason sharing is so important among hunter-gatherers is it's the best way to mitigate risk. Some days you'll have a successful hunt. Some days I'll have a successful hunt. The way we all eat is that you share what you catch and I share what I catch. And also the functioning of the hunter-gatherer band is crucial. So if you're not sharing with us, resentments will build up and all sorts of problems that are dangerous to all of us. So sharing is the central organizing motif in hunter-gatherer societies. And so you don't get these kings, you don't get this coercive power structure until you have farming, until you have accrued resources, accumulated resources that need to be protected, that need to be distributed, that can be counted and taxed, and all these sorts of ills of modernity begin with the advent of agriculture roughly 8,000 years ago at most.
The Holocene. Well, anyway, let me tell my audience who my guest is, Christopher Ryan, whose latest book is called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. It is published by Avid Reader Press. So let's talk a bit more about the hunter-gatherers. Was there equality among the sexes?
Yes, hunter-gatherer women are almost universally have the same status as men do, in some cases greater. And again, as I said, because people have equal access to resources, it's very difficult to control another person. In fact, men tend to be the hunters and women tend to be the gatherers. So the men might go out on hunting trips where the women are gathering fruits and roots and catching small animals and taking care of the children. And the hunting is sort of a high status thing. If you come back with a deer, that's, you know, cause for a party that night. But the women supply about 70 to 80% of the calories in most hunter-gatherer groups. So it would be very hard to tell women what to do when they're feeding the group. You know, they're recognized for that work. In Sex at Dawn, my previous book, we wrote quite a bit about the relationships between the sexes. And the anthropological literature is quite clear that women didn't lose their social status until the advent of agriculture, which is when their position in the world plummeted relative to men. There's a line in the Old Testament I often think about, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife." I always thought that that was an admonition to respect your neighbor's marriage until I read it in context. And it said, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his house, nor his slaves, nor his ox, etc."
So she was his property.
Exactly.
Now, there are hunter-gatherer groups still in the world today, mostly in the Amazon, but I think probably in other parts of the world as well. Do the things that you describe continue with those groups, or have they been influenced by the civilization that they are trying to not be a part of?
Well, some of what I'm describing continues in some areas, but it's rapidly decreasing, unfortunately, because of, you know, the Amazon. We all know what's happening in the Amazon, the fires and the mining and the oil drilling and the fouling of the rivers and so on. It's increasingly difficult to find a place on Earth that isn't contaminated with, you know, the spoils of civilization. But what's important to note is that when we're talking about how our ancestors lived, we're extrapolating from studies of contemporary hunter-gatherers by anthropologists and also reports of first contact from explorers and you know, trappers and so on. And what we're looking for is universalities. So if we find certain qualities that are universal in all of these different accounts that we've read of hunter-gatherers, wherever they are in the world, whether the Inuit in the Arctic or in the Amazon basin or the Australian outback or Papua New Guinea or Africa, what if we find universal qualities, then we can presume that these same qualities pertain to our prehistoric ancestors, because these qualities are a result of the way hunter-gatherers interact with their environment.
But don't they, aren't there sometimes wars between the various groups?
Well, war is, this is obviously
territorial, territorial wars?
This is a very contentious question, because the presumption there is that, first of all, that there is a territorial interest, that people considered land to be theirs. Remember, 10,000, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, there were no more than a few million people on the planet. And they were all nomadic. They were all moving, following animal herds or seasonal changes. They weren't staying in one place. So this idea that you would fight over territory is problematic, because people didn't see property, land, as property. And their nomadic hunter-gatherers, immediate return hunter-gatherers is the technical term, which means by definition they did not have accumulated resources. So if you have nothing to steal, why would anyone attack you? You don't have any possessions. And if you're moving through the landscape, why would you stay and risk your life to fight over a particular piece of land? You just walk away. There's always more land. So some of the presumptions underlying this idea of prehistoric war don't really play out in reality. I think what we tend to do, and this includes myself and other researchers, is that we tend to imagine prehistory is sort of just a more rustic version of today. I call this Flintstonization, this idea of just thinking the past was like today, just a little less refined. I think it's a crisis, a failure of imagination, because in fact, the world was very different, vastly different. The social world we inhabited was radically different, not just a cruder version of where we are now.
You're right that there's a myth of the savage savage. Where does that come from? Is that something that we like to believe so that we can believe that the human situation has improved and that we're better than our ancestors?
Yeah, I think, I was sort of playing with the myth of the noble savage. There's the myth of the savage savage, which is like so much of what I'm arguing in Civilized to Death, is that our sense of prehistory, our sense of where we've come from and where we are, is very much contaminated with propaganda that's masquerading as science. So civilized people consider themselves to be better. Every tribe in the world, basically, if you translate the name of their tribe, it means the people. Everyone thinks they're the people, right? We all think that, no one thinks they have an accent, right? Everyone thinks everyone else has an accent. And so we tend to do this not only spatially, but we also do it in terms of our historical epic. There's a sort of a patriotism for historical periods. And we think that we're better simply because we're here now. Civilized people have always considered people on the periphery to be barbarians and uncouth, and they don't know how to live, they don't know how to act, they don't know. So, of course, it's just because they know how to live their own way, which if you detribalize, as Joseph Campbell put it, sort of step out of your own tribe and try to have a more objective view of things, what you find is that so-called savages often are living much more sophisticated, egalitarian, progressive lives than the so-called civilized people who are condemning them.
And you provide examples of indigenous peoples who rejected the comforts and constraints of civilization. What reasons did they give? How aware were they of what they were rejecting?
Well, in some cases, very aware. I recount the case of the three Fuegians who were picked up by the captain of the Beagle on a previous voyage, Captain Fitzroy.
These are the Fuegians who Charles Darwin also wrote about. We'll get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So Fitzroy, on a previous voyage to South America, picked up these three native people and brought them back to England. He basically kidnapped them. And his idea was that he would bring them to England and show them how superior life was in Europe. And then on the next trip, take them back and put them back with their people so they could tell their people, like, hey, these Europeans are so much better than us. Let's just join them, stop fighting them, stop resisting. So he took them to England. They spent a couple of years there. They met the king and the queen. They learned to speak English. And so they had a very good view of what life was like in Europe. And then they were on the Beagle with Darwin on the famous voyage. And they dropped them off. Fitzroy and Darwin dropped them off and built them huts and gardens and set them up with a European sort of situation there. And then they went on their, Darwin and Fitzroy went on a mapping voyage, and they came back a few months later, and all three of them had disappeared. And when they finally found one of them, Jemmy Button was the nickname they gave him, they asked him why he'd abandoned everything. And he said, I don't know why you want me to work. There are plenty birdies, plenty fishies. Mm-hmm. Saying, like, why do you want me to work for food? There's food everywhere.
But didn't Darwin regard them as, quote, miserable animals rather than human beings with the skill to survive? Many people, we don't think of Darwin in terms of racism, but when you read about what he said about the Fuegians, it's kind of racist.
Well,
he talks about skin color and all sorts of other things along those lines.
Sure, but remember, Darwin, you have to, you know, read these things in context. Darwin was writing in a time where the superiority of white Europeans was unquestioned. He was really one of the first people to question that and to lay the intellectual groundwork for establishing that we all come from the same ancestors, which was a radical idea at that time. So, yes, he was certainly... he was a man of his era, but he was quite progressive. He was anti-slavery, for example, an outspoken opponent of slavery, and he wrote about that quite passionately. But I think that it's only very recently that we've come to the point where we're recognizing the humanity of people who live outside of the circle of civilization, and I'm trying to do what I can to widen that recognition to the point also where we might look back and say, in some ways, hunter-gatherers are more human than we are. Maybe we're less aligned with humanistic values than a lot of hunter-gatherer people are. Maybe we're the savages.
My guest on Leonard Lopate at Large today is Christopher Ryan, whose latest book is Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress.
Each morning a missionary advertises with neon sign. He tells the native population that civilization is dying. Educated savages holler from a bamboo tree. That civilization is a thing for me to see.
So bongo, 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 I don't wanna leave the Congo. No, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongo, I'm so happy in the jungle I refuse to go. Don't want no bright lights, false teeth, doorbells, landlords, I make it clear.
That no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here. I look through a magazine the missionary's wife concealed.
Magazine? What happens?
I see how people who are civilized bung you with automobiles.
You know you can get hurt that way, Daniel?
At the movies they have got to pay many coconuts to see.
What do they see, Donnie?
Uncivilized pictures that the newsreel takes of me.
So, bongo, 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 he don't wanna leave the Congo. No, 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 no.
We'll get back to my guest, Christopher Ryan, in just a moment. But my executive producer, Jesse Lent, joins me now to talk about something, one of the discontents of civilization, the need to survive. And Jesse, welcome to the show. Right now, we are going through a brief period of fundraising here at WBAI, necessitated to some degree because we have to pay our bills and all of that, but also because we've just gone through a rough time where we were cut off the air for over a month because of money problems. So we're asking our audience to come through and help us get past this kind of crisis.
That is true. If you hear the sound of my voice right now, hopefully you notice a distinct improvement in quality. If I stop talking,
have you been gargling?
This is not done by the power of my voice or sheer will. This is our brand new studio, yeah, funded completely by you, our listeners. And in fact,
is our first broadcast from this new studio.
As promised last week, we are in here today for the first time. And I realized, Leonard, that dead air is the kryptonite of radio, but I'm even going to pause for a second here. And if you hear that, the beautiful sound of nothing in this studio. So I think that before we give out the number, I think we just need to say thank you to our listeners and let you know that when you give a donation to this show, Leonard Lopate at Large, or any show on this station, this experiment in community radio, it's not just to pay our checks. I mean, obviously we need to eat too, but really there is a collective action going on here to improve the sound, to improve the station, and hopefully improve the content that you get every day on WBAI and certainly with this show, Leonard Lopate at Large. But we can only continue to make those improvements.
And how can they do that? Is there a number to call?
They can call 516-620-3602 or go to WBAI.org, that is, and donate. Really, any amount helps. And it's the only way that we can continue to make great improvements like this wonderful studio we now find ourselves in.
But we would also hope, if you can see your way to becoming what has been a sustaining member, what called here BAI Buddies, that you would do that. $10 a month or more until you decide you no longer want that to be taken out of the your checking account or
your credit card, your bank account,
whatever you give us.
Yeah.
That really helps us to plan for the future. We are unique in public broadcasting in that we don't take money from any other sources but our listeners. We are totally listener supported, and we do that because we believe that that allows us to be totally independent, to do things that we would not be able to do otherwise, and not have to worry about advertisers or foundations or whatever. But we can only do it if our listeners come through and give us that call at 516-620-3602. Or go to WBAI.org. And we hope that you will do it right now and tell the people here who run the station that the listeners, Leonard Lopate at Large, really want to show their support for what we're doing.
But really, this isn't about us. This is about you. Leonard and I were having our normal morning conversation, preparing the script, preparing the show as we do 5 days a week here. And we were talking about how it really is about the people who care about this broadcast. Now that I realize this is New York City, maybe caring is a little bit smarmy of a word. It is the holidays. Hey, cut me a little slack. But care in the sense of if you're just passing through the radio and you happen to land on this show, obviously we hope you're enjoying it and we hope you'll stay tuned. But I feel like this plea, this request really goes out to the people who are here every day listening to the show or just whenever they can. But that this program, the fact we exist, the fact that this man, Leonard Lopate, is on the air matters to you. You are the ones we are talking to right now, because without listeners like you, we would not still be here. And if everyone, I personally believe, if everyone who did care about this show, about Leonard Lopate at Large being here 5 days a week, could step up and give a donation in whatever amount they're able to, I think we could end this fund drive today. I think we could preempt further fund drives in the future and prevent our own show from being preempted. But the only way to do that is if you're one of those listeners to step up, go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602. And of course, be sure to make that contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large.
And thank you. And I want to go back to our guest, Christopher Ryan, whose latest book is Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress, from Avid Reader Press, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. He is the author, a co-author with his wife, of Sex at Dawn, which was a bestseller. And he's also the host of a weekly podcast, Tangentially Speaking. Maybe that's why he is so articulate. You share a name with Christopher Columbus. You mentioned him earlier. Christopher Columbus, you write, described the native people of the West Indies as the best people in the world and, above all, the gentlest. He said they had kindness, generosity, physical beauty, simple. They were simple, honest. They had love toward others in preference to themselves. And yet, didn't he enslave them?
Yeah, that passage that you're quoting from one of the letters he sent back to the King and Queen of Spain is one of the most chilling things I've ever read. He, as you say, he describes the people as being simple and generous and healthy and kind. And if you express admiration for anything, they'll just give it to you immediately, showing this generosity principle that I mentioned earlier, that they basically lived in paradise. And he said in Spanish, he said, seguramente es gente que viven en Dios. These are people who live in God, literally.
But then he wrote, with 50 men, we could subjugate all of them as slaves. They would make very fine servants. That was him advancing the notion of civilization.
That's it. And gold. He immediately enslaved the people and instituted a quota. They needed to bring a certain amount of gold every week, and if they failed, they had their hands chopped off. And those who tried to escape were hunted with dogs and just murdered. And within, I forget the exact numbers, but within 10, 15 years, over 90% of the people on Hispaniola were dead. And to call this bringing civilization is maddening. The people who were living there were living in a way that increased human happiness. And when Columbus arrived, this, you know, conqueror, this conquistador, what he brought was quite the opposite of progress.
Now, what about growing up in these societies? You write about how the brain of the troubled teen is a product of modern culture. Adolescents didn't go through a troubled period, as they seem to among many mammals?
No. The research on hunter-gatherers indicates that children, and I think we find this everywhere, children have a natural hunger to learn how to be adults, playing with dolls, playing, you know, learning to hunt and build things. And it's quite natural that the young of any species is fascinated by the behavior of the adults, of the older members, and wants to learn to participate. The problem is that in the modern world, things are changing so quickly that you don't know what world it is you're supposed to be preparing for because it hasn't arrived yet. The world can be very intimidating for young people now and for older people because the world we grow up in is not the world that we spend our adult lives living in. Everything's changing so quickly. And I think that is very disruptive and troubling for a species. So in hunter-gatherer groups, there really is no concept of adolescence. You're either a child or you're an adult, and there are clear rites of passages that delineate the difference. In fact, in most hunter-gatherer groups, you have a different name when you become an adult. When a girl becomes a woman or a boy becomes a man, is a very clear separation, and you're given a new name based upon your personality and your experiences. And there isn't this long sort of intermediate period where you feel that you're ready to participate in the adult world, but you're not yet admitted and you're still dependent and humiliated. This is a very difficult period for contemporary kids that really finds no correlation in hunter-gatherer groups.
You write that forager girls tended to begin menstruating at an older age than today, at 16 or 17. How would we know that?
We know that because of contemporary hunter-gatherers, and that ovulation is triggered by a combination of hormonal changes and body fat content. Hunter-gatherer women have very low body fat proportional to or compared to contemporary girls and women and men. And so, you know, we have girls beginning to menstruate now at 11 or 12 years of age. And the reason this is significant is that if you compare a hunter-gatherer woman's life to a modern woman's life, both in the age of onset of menstruation and when you look at a typical hunter-gatherer woman would have had three or maybe four children and breastfed those children for 3 to 4 years, each one. If you run the numbers, what you find is that contemporary women go through menstrual cycles about four times as frequently as hunter-gatherer women did, which means that their body is going through those hormonal changes and surges and fluctuations so much more often than the body was designed for, if, you know, designed in air quotes, evolved for. And contemporary researchers think that this may be an important factor in breast and uterine cancer, because women are going through this menstrual period so much more often. It takes a toll on the body, which can show up as cancer.
We talk a lot about the dangers of climate change, but didn't climate change change everything for hunter-gatherers, the climate change of the Holocene period leading to the transition to agriculture? I would have thought what I've read in my history books is that led to abundance and allowed for more leisure time. Is that a bad thing?
Well, that's what we're told, isn't it? But if you look at hunter-gatherer studies of hunter-gatherer groups, you find that very few of them work more than 20 hours per week. And when I say work, what I'm referring to are things that we do on vacation, hunting, fishing, picnicking. These are things that we do on weekends and hunter-gatherers do all the time. But even so, they're only doing these sorts of productive activities 20 hours a week or less. So I don't, you know, I think this is one of those things that we've all heard, that agriculture gave us leisure time. But I don't know about, I don't know how much leisure time you have right now, but I work a lot more than 20 hours a week. I don't know anyone who is getting by on less than 20 hours a week of work. And also, hunter-gatherers don't even have a word for work in most of the languages.
Well, I don't appreciate much more leisure time. I don't play golf, so that's a problem.
Yeah.
But the development of agrarian societies led to more structures and rules, including the nuclear family. And in your previous book, the bestseller, New York Times bestseller, Sex at Dawn, that you co-authored with your psychiatrist wife, you argued that humans have never been wired to be monogamous and that the societal insistence on monogamy can be harmful. Really? So there's no monogamy within the hunter-gathering groups?
We don't see evidence for sexual exclusivity. What we see in hunter-gatherer groups and also in studies of human reproductive anatomy and physiology, and also when looking at the primates most closely related to humans, all of these windows into our past point to groups that practiced what we would consider to be a more promiscuous mating system. But when I say it's difficult to use that word, because when we use the word promiscuous today, we think about people having sex with strangers and sort of casual hookups. And it's important to understand that our ancestors, there were no strangers.
So paternity was really a communal thing rather than an individual thing?
Right. Yeah. The presumption that paternity certainty has always been a prime concern to our species finds no support in the evidence. In fact, what we find is many hunter-gatherer groups don't even know that sex causes pregnancy in the first case. So, you know, that sort of throws a wrench into the calculation. Another thing that we find is very interesting is called partible paternity by anthropologists, which is a belief that a child can have several different fathers biologically, not just in a spiritual sense or, you know, friends of one's mother or something. The belief is that a fetus is literally made of accumulated semen. And so a woman who wants to have a child who's smart and funny and good looking and strong will have sex with the smart guy and the funny guy and the good looking guy and the strong guy in order to get all those qualities into her child. And then when the child's born, each of those men will acknowledge their paternity of the child. So, we find in studies of hunter-gatherers, notions of parenthood tend to be dispersed among the group. Children refer to all women as mother and all men as father. And, the idea that this is my child and I have the exclusive responsibility to educate and care for the child isn't common in hunter-gatherer groups. It's quite the opposite.
We don't have much more time, but it's unlikely that we're going to return to hunter-gathering type communities. So what can we learn from all of this, and how can we apply it to our current situation?
Right. I don't advocate a return to hunter-gatherer life.
Even if you did, it's not going to happen.
No, exactly. I think that what we can do is, moving forward with a more informed sense of what sort of creature we are and what sort of environment, both social and ecological, works best for us. You know, there's the great line from T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets, where he said, we shall not cease from exploring, and the end of all our exploration will be to return to where we began and know the place for the first time. I think that's what I hope we'll do as a species. I think that on a species level, we're sort of on a, you know, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. We've gone out, like in the Odyssey, and we're having these experiences and learning important lessons. And I hope that before we past the point of no return, we will return. We will turn back toward home and we'll create lives for ourselves that are much more likely to be meaningful and healthy based upon an understanding of where we came from.
So you suggest that we should know our species and bring hunter-gatherer thinking into our modern lives by forming horizontally organized collectives.
Well, that's one way. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
That's called socialism, isn't it?
Well, it could be called socialism. It could be called cooperation and community.
And being less competitive, you mean?
And understanding what it is we're competing for, questioning the premise here. There's a whole section in Civilized to Death where I look at research into people who are very wealthy. And that research shows that great wealth does not correlate to great happiness. So who benefits from all this competition? Who benefits when even the winners aren't happier? What's going on here? I think there's an opportunity for some very subversive thinking when you start to question, the value of the prizes. It's like we're at the carnival where you spend $20 shooting at some target, and if you hit it, you get a $3 trinket. It's a scam. And I think that we need to question the basis of modern civilization and really question, does this make us healthier and happier? The evidence is to the contrary. And so if we accept that conclusion, then we have to start looking at what will make us healthier and happier. And in many cases, the answer lies in an understanding of where we came from.
Christopher
Ryan.
Number
one, yes.
Go ahead, say it, but quickly.
I was just going to say the number one predictor of a healthy, happy life is whether or not you feel embedded in a community of loving people who trust you and love you. That comes directly from our prehistoric past.
Christopher Ryan's book, Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress, is from Avid Reader Press. How can people access your podcast, Tangentially Speaking?
Oh, and anywhere any app that for podcasting, it's there. Okay. And my webpage is thatchrisryan.com.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been a pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Kate Gwan Allison, who produced this segment. If you're new to our program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter and our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find all of our past shows, links to them. We are preempted tomorrow for WBAI's Fun Drive programming, and we will be preempted on Wednesday for the station's special coverage of the impeachment hearings. Although if they end early, we might be back on. But we're definitely going to be back on Thursday with Rachel Glickhouse, who will discuss her ProPublica article, Police Don't Do a Good Job Tracking Hate Crimes. A new report calls on Congress to take action. And we'll see you then. By the way, as we said earlier, our pledge line is active once again, so why not show your support for Leonard Lopate at Large by making a donation of any amount right now by calling 516-620-3602 or going to WBAI.org and following the instructions. In the past, we've told you about all the expenses we have at the station, like our antenna, phones, equipment, rent, of course, but even ever since WBAI was knocked off the air for a month by a rogue faction of the Pacifica Network, the need has become even greater. We need your help just to get our facilities back to the level they were at before the station was taken over and partly destroyed. I'm happy to report that we are now broadcasting from our new studio, which has been under construction for the better part of the last year, and I hope you've heard an improvement in the sound quality and reduction of noise. But that is another reason that we need all of our listeners to please step up and show support to keep the quality of Leonard Lopate at Large up to the standard that our listeners expect and to make sure that this show is never interrupted again. The best way to do that is to make a contribution of any amount that you can. And if you can see your way to becoming a BAI buddy by making a sustaining monthly donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, you can do that by going to our website, WBAI.org, or by calling 516-620-3602. Every amount helps, whatever you can give. And remember, we don't take money from foundations. We don't take them from advertisers. We just rely on you. Whatever level you can contribute at, the important thing is that you step up and give. And thank you from all of us at Leonard Lopate at Large for your generous support. We'll see you on Thursday.